the democratic forces in this country, the workers, the laborers, the small farmers, the minorities, the women who fought for their rights, that is the essence of democracy. And to the extent that life today is at all bearable for us and humane for us, to the extent that we are not ground to pieces, it's because of those democratic forces, because they can't go just so far. To the extent that we can argue today, the fact that I can sit up here and speak to you is not because this system of democratic capitalism, so-called democratic, gave me that right. They never gave us anything. We had to extract those rights from them.
That's Michael Parenti, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Michael Parenti on democracy. Discussions about democracy probably start in Athens about 2,500 years ago. A truism is society is democratic to the extent that its citizens play a meaningful role in managing public affairs. Democracy is located within the capitalist economic system, infamous for producing colossal inequality. There's no level playing field as great income and wealth translate into political power for the haves at the expense of the have-nots. We have procedural democracy, elections, broadcast debates, primaries, etc. Citizens are largely marginalized, overwhelmed by big money and powerful lobbies. Look at the widespread demand to ban assault weapons of war, or for universal single-payer health care, or protecting the environment, or affordable housing. People want those things, but elites have a simple message. Vote, then go home, and leave everything to us. Actual democracy is hollowed out. A Davos-type class rules. Our guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti was a leading independent political analyst, scholar, and author. Cornel West called him a towering prophetic voice. He taught at major colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy for the Few, Power and the Powerless, and Against Empire. He passed away on January 24th at the age of 92. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1984. And now, Michael Parenti on capitalism.
I want to talk about capitalism. I think maybe it's time we do. It's a remarkable thing that you can take courses in political science and study institutions and policies and all, and never once is it mentioned that we live in a capitalist system. Now, I maintain that it's time we talk about that subject, because capitalism is a system which spins off enormous imperatives which prefigure much of political life and limit it. Ours is a capitalist system. What that means is that the land, the labor, the resources, the capital, the technology, all these things are used for the purpose of accumulating capital. The goal of capitalism is not to create jobs. In fact, capitalists will eliminate jobs if they can. It cuts labor costs. Nor is the purpose of capitalism to build communities. Capitalism will build or destroy communities as investment opportunities dictate. Nor is it the purpose to create a better life and a better environment for the generations yet to come. Capitalism, the corporations, will use the environment as a septic tank if it serves their profit purposes, and they won't even help the generation that's struggling with it right now, let alone the ones to come. Nor is the purpose of capitalism to create efficiency and avoid waste, because capitalism constantly pours its inefficiencies and diseconomies onto the public and into the public realm in the form of unemployment, injuries, unsafe products, pollution, things of that sort. No, ladies and gentlemen, capitalism has only one goal, and that's to make money for the capitalists. Karl Marx was right in Volume 1 of Capital. That's what it's about. Are we applauding? I hope you're applauding my criticism and not that goal. Nor is it because the capitalist is evil or venal. individual capitalists are nice guys, some of them. It is the first law of capitalism, which is that you must make a profit or you go out of business. That's what it's about. It would be true for you too, even if you went in with all the heartfelt desires to help the public, help your workers, do this and do that, and so forth. If you did those things, you go out of business. If you decide not to foreclose on your tenants or on the notes you hold, then you'll lose them. And if they go to a good bank that feels like you and they won't foreclose and throw the people out, then that good bank, there ain't no such bank, but that bank will fail. And then the notes will be picked up by another bank, which will know what to do and will understand that the name of the game is capitalism. The function is to accumulate capital. That is the essence, the raison d'etre, the driving force in this society. Capitalism has no loyalty to nation or to flag or to democracy or, for that matter, to autocracy or to God or to atheism or to any of those isms or any of those things. It has no loyalty to family. There's no social force in human history to compare to capitalism when it comes to the destruction of traditional values, the Gemeinschaft values of homegrown rural and city life, the extended family, the clan, and now even the nuclear family. It pounds away at things, as Marx says, and it recreates everything in its own image. It has no loyalty to anything but itself. It is a remarkably rational system. That's what it's there for. It has no sentiment in it. It is imperative. All things, all people, all commodities, all values are reduced to instrumental objects to serve this end purpose, which is to make money in order to invest it, to make more money, to invest it, to make more money, to invest it, to make more money. As Marx said, it's money, with money the capitalist produces commodities and services, which then give him more money. The function is to accumulate capital. Accumulate, 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 as Marx said, driving on endlessly. It is not to make automobiles, it's not to make clothing, it's to make money. And if the capitalist can make bad clothing and cheap clothing, that'll make him more money, he'll do it that way. But don't take my word for it. Let's take David Roderick's word for it. He's head of U.S. Steel Corporation. And he said, U.S. Steel is not in the business of making steel. He said it. It's in the business of making profits. Unquote. Take the word of Henry Ford II, whose dedication to capitalism is above suspicion. Several years ago, when he was before the Ribicoff Committee on Automobile Safety, more than seven, more like 15 years ago, and why are automobiles so unsafe, Ribicoff was saying, and what's going on, isn't that? Ford finally turned around and he said, look, Senator, Ford Motor Companies isn't in the safety business. And he went better than Roderick. He made it more accurate. Because capital, the function of capital is not to make profits. He said it correctly. He said, Ford Motor Company is in the business of making the highest possible profits for its stockholders. That's the crucial point, remember. It's all relative. If you got your capital in here and you're only getting an 8% return, you yank it out and you put it there, even if you leave a community destitute where you can get 15%. So you must make as much as you can. Now, what dictates the allocation of these resources? What dictates how the land, the labor, and the capital, and the technology of our society will be used is this imperative and not social need or human need. If I'm a shoe manufacturer and you're all barefoot, that datum is of extreme indifference to me. I couldn't care less. You may need shoes, but I don't give you shoes because I'm not in the business of giving them to you. Your need does not dictate production and investment. It is your buying power, and that we call buying power plus want equals market. Now, if you need shoes or may just want them, you may have 20 pairs home already, then I become interested. And nor can I do it any other way, because I'm not in the business of philanthropy. I'm not in the business of feeding the poor. When the Citizens Committee on Hunger and Malnutrition in America went to U.S. Food Corporation and said, what are you doing about the fact that 12 million Americans in this country do not have enough to eat, U.S. Food said, If we saw the opportunity for a profitable return on investment, we'd move into that area. And the Citizens Committee was indignant. But the Citizens Committee was wrong, and U.S. Food was right. One of those two groups understood what the system was about, and it wasn't the U.S. and it wasn't the Citizens Committee. It was the capitalists. There are only two groups in this country who understand what that system is about, and it's the capitalists and the Marxists. They both understand what it's about. And I agree with everything the capitalists say about how they operate, not then all the tinsels and all the justification and ideologies they put on it, on top of it. So things which have no profit but are a great social value can become totally neglected or even abused by the system. Things like the environment, human life, human health. Things which have little social value but great profit will attract great investment, like chintzy cars with a lot of chrome on them and such. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've uncovered a mystery. We've uncovered the mystery that has plagued liberals so long, which is, and conservative critics of government too, who profess to know the answer to that, which is, why are we unable to solve our social problems of unemployment, environmental devastation, the decay of the cities, inadequate health care? The mystery is solved. We cannot solve these problems because that isn't what our land, labor, and resources are dedicated to. They're dedicated to something else. The end of the mystery. That changes our perception of it. Our social problems, therefore, if my analysis is correct so far, if I've brought you along this far, manipulating you, you know, like the way we Reds do, right? If I brought you along so far, then the very definition of social problem changes. Heretofore, we've thought of these problems as irrational spin-offs from a basically rational system, as aberrations. What I would argue now is that these problems are the rational outcomes of a basically irrational system. Pollution is rational. It's correct. It makes sense. It's correct for Goodyear Tire Company to go into Connecticut and build on the Mill River a factory and then dump its raw chemical industrial effusion into the Mill River, which took nature 100 billion years to create, which is used for recreation, for drinking water, for fishing, and all these, and destroy it and turn it into an open sewer. It's rational to do that because they cut their production costs and they increase their profits, which is their essence, the capital accumulation process. That's rational. It's correct. It's not correct from a human point of view. It's not correct from social values. But as I pointed out, capitalism has nothing to do with those social values. And when pressed on that, they will tell you. When you say you've polluted the environment, are you going to clean it up? And said, it's too big a problem for us. They're big enough to dirty it. They're not big enough to clean it up. And that's correct, too, because when they dirty it, they increase their margins of profits. When they clean it up, they would go broke. And they're not in the business of philanthropy, of doing anything that doesn't bring a profit. And we learn, too, that military waste is rational and correct. There is no such thing as waste under capitalism if it's bringing in a profit. It's wasteful to see two workers standing idly for 10 minutes. It's wasteful to produce a product which doesn't sell as highly as you want. But it's not wasteful to have two contracts of $1 billion each to build almost identical fighter planes, one from the Navy, one from the Air Force. That's not wasteful. That's wonderful. That's twice as much business. That's twice as much profit. And when liberals like Senator Proxmire get up and says, our military budget is riddled with duplication and waste, let us remind ourselves that that is correct for capitalism. It's wasteful for the taxpayers. It's wasteful for the loss in human services and the other things for us. But it's not wasteful for those guys at the end of the trough who are holding the contracts. When you look at military spending and you see, first, it doesn't compete with the civilian market, the consumer market. When you produce refrigerators and you make profits, you produce more refrigerators, make profits, you produce more and more, you begin to cut your margin on profit per commodity. Now what you do is you're taking your profits and you're putting them into another whole area of demand and investment, which does not compete with your civilian markets. Second, it's an area which has a built-in obsolescence. So that means you no sooner spend $10 billion on one weapon system when you find out that it's kind of obsolete and you need a whole new weapon system. So it's constantly generating new demand and false demand. Third, it has guaranteed cost overruns. of anywhere from 200 to 300 to 900%, and now we see with some of our hammers and screwdrivers, 20,000% of cost overruns. Those aren't cost overruns, those are fixed prices. But cost overruns like the C-5A transport plane, which was contracted for $1 billion, and the company then turns around and says, sorry, it cost us $3 billion. And the Pentagon says, oh, $3 billion? $3 billion. What do you want? $7 billion? You know, whatever you want. It's not their money. Fourth, it's a contracted market, military spending. Unlike the automobile manufacturer who has to worry about selling those automobiles, these things have already been contracted. You've already guaranteed you're going to be paid for your production. You already have a market. Fifth, there's no competitive bidding, at least not in 95% of the contracts. That's an extraordinary thing. It means that any price you give the Pentagon, they take. Oh, is that how much? Okay, sure. We just said that. Finally, it's a form of public spending that does not expand the non-profit public sector. It does not expand those human services areas and those kinds of things. It doesn't bring in socialistic patterns of answering to human needs. It's like any other private contract that a company might get. They want tanks, it's like someone wants cars or something. In fact, Chrysler switches from cars to tanks and now back to cars. And it provides, given all that, the highest possible profits. So you see, the next time you talk about how bloated the military budget is, remember, it's quite rational. It's a rational outcome for a fundamentally irrational, insane system. That system is dedicated to the accumulation of wealth. But where does wealth come from? What is wealth? Well, wealth has two sources. One, the natural resources of our environment, the timber, the ore, the sun, the earth, all the things that can produce certain things. And second, the labor that goes into making those things. The thing that transforms a tree, which is a non-marketable item, although it's a very valuable item, into a commodity which brings profits to the capitalist, is the labor that goes into it, into that process. The labor that goes into harvesting the timber, the labor that goes into floating it down the river, transforming it into lumber, the labor that goes into making it into a chair or a piece of furniture, the labor that goes into the machines that are used to do all this, the labor that goes into getting it up on the truck and into the furniture store and writing the advertising copy and the salesman standing there, and the labor that went into making that truck and all that sort of thing. It's labor. Labor that creates wealth. Capital does not create wealth. Capital does not produce anything. There was an ad I saw in the paper not long ago which said, what will capital be doing on Labor Day when all the workers will be out there at the barbecue pits? Capital will be working. It will still be building factories and homes and hospitals. We will put our capital to use here at, I forget what firm it was talking about that. That's not true, ladies and gentlemen. You could be rich as Rockefeller. You'd have all the money in the world and you could not build this building. You could not build this lectern. Only labor could do that. You could have all the capital in the world because capital is nothing but dead labor. If you work all summer and you finish that summer and you've saved $2,000 from your work, that $2,000 represents your labor of what you did before. Now, any capital that you have which you do not use for immediate consumption has to be mixed back with labor in order to have any kind of survival or vitality. Capital is nothing but pieces of paper, numbers and accounts. That's all the Rockefellers have. Stocks, you see, and things aside from their own direct capital holdings of, you know, their personal capital like estates and houses and jewelry, which those things too are worthless unless there's someone who has the money to buy them. When you make that money, you've got to put it back. You've got to take that dead capital and mix it again with living capital, you see. Not me, I'll put my money in a bank and then just live off it if I want. But what do you think a bank is? The only reason the bank gives you 7 or 8% is because the bank itself is an investment house. It will then invest it and lend it out to someone else at 13 or 14%. And the only reason that someone else will take it at 14% is that he will then use it to employ people and make 19 or 20% or 50% or whatever else he might make. So that's what the system is about. It's labor which creates wealth. And the way to become wealthy is to pay workers less than the wealth that they create. That's the secret to getting rich. It's not to work hard, but to get others to work hard for you. Corporations today are called producer interests. They don't produce anything. They are organizational devices for the mobilization and accumulation of capital. But what the capitalist does is not only expropriate the workers' labor power, he also expropriates the worker's name. It's the worker, it's the ordinary working people who are the producers. And the more you pay those people, the less there's going to be for you. That's the problem for the capitalist. We'll get into that in a minute. The plot thickens. Don't managers produce? There was an encyclical put out by the Pope in which he said management too does very important work and makes decisions and plans. Yes, indeed. Management is not the owners. Managers work, and they should be paid. They shouldn't be paid $3 million a year, but they should be paid something because they do make important and vital decisions of planning and business decisions if you want to run a company that way. They do work. Most top managers, however, have so much capital in savings that for all intents and purposes they are part of the capitalist class themselves. But any middle manager works. He can get laid off tomorrow and thrown out on the street just like a steel worker. And many are so happening. Profits are the thing you make when you don't work. Income tax form used to have unearned income. Does it still have that? I don't remember. Earned income and unearned, that's marvelous, that little element of truth, very uncharacteristic of our government. Unearned income, that's the return you get on your interests and your investments. As you put your money to work, your money doesn't work, you put your money to command labor to bring you more money. What about your profits, Parenti? Don't you make royalties on your book? Yeah, but I wrote the book, Schtunk, what do you think I did? I sat there for 2 years, sweating and researching that book. And take another year on every new edition of it. That's my labor that goes into that book. And the people who do the copy editing, and the editor, and the printers, and the advertising, and all those people put their labor into that book, and that's where they get their salaries. The profits on that book go to the former Prime Minister of England named Harold Macmillan. The Macmillan family owns St. Martin's Press. I saw him on the Dick Cavett show one night, and Dick Cavett said, "How do you sustain yourself? What are you doing now?" And he says, "Our family has a little publishing house that does quite well." And I looked at him, and I said, "No." "He makes more money on my book than I do. And he doesn't even know my name. And he doesn't even know half the titles that the publishing house puts out. He doesn't know any of them, probably. But what he does know is the bottom line. That is the parasite. That is the extortion. That's the highwayman. That's the toll keeper. That's the guy who takes it from you as you pass through. You cannot, you're extorted all the time. You cannot put a piece of bread into a toaster without making money for the Rockefellers or the DuPonts or the Mellons or the Morgans. Remember that. You cannot flick on a switch for light. That utility company is taking a shave of that, which has nothing to do with the production of electricity or social needs, and giving that to the people who sit around big tables in Chicago and New York, who then use that money for all sorts of other purposes, namely the mobilization of political power. Now, there's a contradiction, of course, in trying to maximize your profits, and that has to do with wages and employing people. And when I say workers, I don't mean only in steel plants. God, it's a steam bath in here. Is everybody as warm as I am? Or am I just getting worked up? I don't know. That's as far as it goes. There's a contradiction that comes in. As I say, when I say workers, I mean just about everybody. I mean even if you work after getting a college degree in a high-tech firm and doing other things, you're still a worker. You can be fired. I remember a Black Panther years ago who said it. He said, "Either you own the mother or you work for it." He used a longer word than mother, but he said, "Either you own the mother or you work for it." And that's what it is. Now, wages, because they cut into profits, must be kept down. That is the historic struggle between capital and labor. Wages, because they are the source of buying power and they create markets, must be kept up. That becomes one of the contradictions. And Marx put it very simply. He said, recessions occur when the workers produce produce more goods and services than they're able to buy back. There's this chronic tendency, a tendency toward a falling rate of profit, a tendency toward instability in the profit area, a need to cut back on labor, a need to mechanize, to save there, but then to find yourself with higher fixed costs and therefore needing more productivity to overcome the fixed costs. I've just given you now, and we're going to leave it, I've just given you all of Volume 1 of Capital. Not all of it, but enough maybe for tonight. Now, what is the role of the state? The state has several functions, as you know. The first function may be to carry out common functions that can't be carried out any other way. Another function is to provide for the common defense. And by the way, Marx and Engels recognized both those functions in the German ideology. They mention it just in the paragraph and pass over it. But the third function is to maintain the existing class structure, to maintain the interests of those who control the property and the wealth of society. And that means servicing wealth. For instance, in the late 1800s, the U.S. government gave away one half of all the land in the United States, literally hundreds of thousands of acres in leases on coal, oil, etc., for a small percentage of their worth, and what was one of the greatest giveaways, it boggles the mind, to the capitalist interests of this society. It increases services, subsidies, regulations, it helps create demand by having big military budgets, all these things, and it also acts as a protector of wealth against those who don't have any wealth. That is the ultimate function of the state, as Engels said, beginning historically with those small bands of armed men who protect those who have wealth against those who don't. Don't take my word for it again. Let's hear what Adam Smith says. Again, impeccable credentials, who, in his Wealth of the Nations in 1776, quote, "Civil authority is in reality instituted for the security of property, for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all." So said Thomas Hobbes also. So said Plato and Aristotle, for that matter. So said John Locke. So said John Harrington and James Otis and James Madison. They all said it and they approved of it. They saw it as a social necessity. When Marx came along and said it, but critically, and said this is unjust and wrong, then everybody dropped the subject. And today, one would not say that thing, that civil authority is instituted to defend the rich against the rest of us. Now, that class oppression of using labor as harshly, as fast as you can, extracting as much wealth from it as you can, forcing it to work 10 hours if you can, as in 1820, and having them work 12 and 13 hours by 1830, and having them work 15, 18 hours by 1840, and then bringing in little kids to work because they can't fight back and they're more malleable, and bringing in women to work because they could be bullied and intimidated, and doing this on and on, that class oppression does activate and evoke a reaction. That is, people fight back. So what you have is not only class oppression, but class struggle, a constant struggle. That class struggle is going on today still. The fact you don't have large masses of workers walking through the streets carrying red banners and singing the Internationale doesn't mean you don't have class struggle. Strikes, there still are plenty of them, more than ever. Demonstrations, sabotage, absenteeism, speed-ups, slowdowns, even fights over how much time a worker can take going to the laboratory, or what a boss may presume of his or her secretary. Every day, these kinds of struggles, a constant grinding away of capital against labor and a constant fight back of labor and resistance of labor against capital. That struggle is carried on into the public arena, into the state, and it's carried on, by the way, into the entire world. As the exploitation of the third world expands, so does the government functions, so does the size of the government that rules, from a principality to a nation to a confederation until finally to a global international network of counterinsurgency right-wing client states to extract labor from the third world at a rate, by the way, which is two and three times more exploitative than it is here in the United States. And you can understand why capital goes abroad. It's better to employ assemblers of transistors in Taiwan, women in the factory, or in South Korea, where you work them 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, one Sunday off a month, and you pay them something like $12, $15 a week. It's better than to employ people in Ohio to do that sort of thing. And you can sell it for pretty much the same price. Your profits are much bigger. They don't go there, by the way, to give you a lower price. They don't do all that to save you money. They go there to make more profits.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on capitalism. This is Independent Alternative Radio.
So the struggle is not only in this country. The struggle between labor and capital is throughout the world. It's in El Salvador. It's in Nicaragua. It's in just about every one of these countries you want to name. Again, this leads us to think about another thing, which is the myth of gradualism. The idea that the gains and the improvements and the advances that have been made in this country have been because democratic capitalism, as some writers have insisted, is a system which gradually goes along and opens things up and is creative and allows and actually creates these reforms. Well, it's really very distorting to credit capitalism with reforms which, in fact, the capitalists resisted tooth and nail, which were shoved down their throats, which were carried out despite their wishes, and which, in many cases, they then benefited from in certain ways later on, and reforms which are needed because of social problems which they created. It's some joke to credit somebody with reform when he's created the problem. But there have been reforms, and this is the point to be made. That struggle created procedural democracy as well as substantive democracy. The democratic forces in this country, the workers, the laborers, the small farmers, the minorities, the women who fought for their rights, that is the essence of democracy. And to the extent that life today is at all bearable for us and humane for us, to the extent that we are not ground to pieces, it's because of those democratic forces, because they can't go just so far. To the extent that we can argue today, the fact that I can sit up here and speak to you is not because this system of democratic capitalism, so-called democratic, gave me that right. They never gave us anything. We had to extract those rights from them. And I'm sitting up here because of people in generations before who fought for years for free public education so I, as a son of an immigrant and a poor worker, could go to school and even go to college and get some fellowships. That's how I did it. I didn't do it on my own initiative. There was a whole social system. There was no such thing, ladies and gentlemen, as individual initiative and individual accomplishment in a vacuum. There are millions of other people who came before you. And when you go down that ski slope and you see how great you go, remember, there were people who designed those skis, there were people who built those slopes, who made that equipment, who made the stuff you're wearing. You are engaging in a social activity. There's almost nothing that isn't a social activity. And that freedom of speech, which I have, is only because people fought for that freedom against Pinkertons and goons and county sheriffs. 40 years ago, a talk like this would have been barricaded, and those goons would have been coming in here with their deputies, and we've all been arrested in certain towns, maybe Boulder for one of them, or certainly in towns in Colorado, or during the free speech fights of the Wobblies in the 1920s. So the rights that we have are because of the power that we have. And they make us think differently. They make us think that freedom and power are two things which are antithetical. No. It's only when the people have power and can reclaim some of that power, to the extent that we can reclaim that, then they have the freedom. And so I have the freedom to speak here tonight. People of my persuasion do not have the freedom to speak on ABC or NBC or CBS. George will. George will has that freedom because he went to the right prep school and he enunciates. The prep school doesn't mean anything. I went to Yale, big deal. But it's that he enunciates the views of that ruling class interest. He gets up there and he doesn't go beyond a certain line. And when those reporters and media commentators say, we're free to say what we want, they're free to say what they want just as long as others like what they say. I mean, they can say what they like as long as others like what they say. That is, those who employ them. That's where the freedom goes. Our persuasion is yet not free to speak and be heard on the networks because the people have not yet fully challenged or in fact had access to that area of power and wealth, which is undemocratic. When Colonel George Mason got up at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 and he said, "Let's have a Bill of Rights," that proposal was voted down unanimously. It was voted down unanimously. James Madison voted it down too. It was only after he saw the turmoil that was going on over the issue and he got some letters from Jefferson urging him to think otherwise from Paris that he changed his mind and introduced the Bill of Rights. The idea that the framers of the Constitution, called the Founding Fathers, gave us this Bill of Rights is very misleading and very wrong. The Bill of Rights was voted down unanimously by those men of wealth and affluence, the big merchants, the landowners, the shippers, the bankers, and the manufacturers who sat in Philadelphia in 1787. It was only their fear of the democratic forces. It was only their fear that perhaps this Constitution would not get ratified that made them finally make the concession and make the pledge that in the first Congress they would introduce 10 amendments in, or whatever it was, I think it was originally 12, whatever, but would institute a Bill of Rights. It was only then that the believers in real democracy, but the men of wealth and affluence distrusted democracy. They feared it. And in the 1820s and 1830s, when workers who were disfranchised agitated for the vote, they weren't given the vote. They won it through agitation and struggle and conflicts, many of which bordered on the violent, many of which were violent. And it was then that the elites in the states like Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and New York got together in their state conventions and opened up the franchise to universal manhood suffrage. And women were never given the vote. You were never given the vote. It was that your sisters from generations before agitated and they got spit at and they got garbage thrown at them and some of them died of pneumonia in prisons and they were force-fed and they were humiliated and they fought and fought and fought and it just took a mere 100 years and they got the vote, right? That's the gradualism that responds to a new need and gives, oh, sure, here you are. It takes enormous struggle to forcibly extract these concessions, these democratic concessions from a plutocracy, an oligarchy that distrusts and hates and fears democracy in its heart, which will use democracy when it can buy the elections, when it can have the affluent candidates. And you were never given the 8-hour day. It was fought for by labor. And most of the free speech was fought for by labor. It was the working people in this country that settled the issue of the First Amendment. As late as the 1920s, in most communities, the sheriff could arrest any labor agitator he wanted, hit him over the head and throw him in jail, shove castor oil down his throat if he wanted. And it was the Wobbly Free Speech Act. It was thousands of men and even some women coming along, riding the rails, coming into a town, taking it over for days and giving all the speeches they wanted, agitating and agitating and exercising free speech because they understood something which those who preach to us, the apologists of the system, don't understand today, which is that the best way to preserve your freedom and your rights is to exercise them vigorously. As with the physical body, so with the body politic. Our freedoms, our democracy is strongest when we exercise it and extend it. And so it is with any gain that the democratic forces have made. Social Security, child labor laws, unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, all these things, capitalism cannot be credited with that because the rulers resisted those things. With divisions among the ruling class, with some saying, look, give them a little bit so we can keep a lot, and others saying, no, you give them a little, you'll open the floodgates and we'll be inundated, but we must hold firm, and the more liberal capitalists winning out on many issues, and the conservatives winning out on many other issues. Now, what capitalists do with this enormous surplus value that they accumulate is several things. One, they reinvest the bulk of it to make yet more money for themselves. Two, they use a very handsome amount of it for personal consumption. The DuPonts, contrary to the myth that they live frugally, the DuPonts have 24 estates in the state of Delaware alone, which pretty well takes up the state of Delaware when you think about it. It's really... Three, they live off it in leisure. There are about 3 or 4 million families in America that live off the labor of others that don't work. And I think it's counted up to 6 or 7 million individuals, quite a few, who live without working, although they fiercely reject any suggestion that they do so. They do. And four, they also use a lot of their surplus capital to gain political influence through direct occupancy of public offices. And by the way, every person who has been elected president of the United States since Warren Harding, I'd say, with the possible exception of Harry Truman, has been a millionaire either when he went into the White House or by the time he left the White House. They're all either millionaires or close to it. And as for Congress, we know what the power of the moneyed interest is there. Will Rogers said it, Congress is the best that money could buy. And also, in another way, a far more profound way, not just in the instrumental way of buying policies and buying politicians and all that, the capitalist state itself is wedded to its system. There's really not much it could do without regard for the health of the economy. But the health of the economy is the health of the capitalist economy. And high productivity, maintaining high levels of profits, these kinds of things are the goals of the corporations, the banks, and these are the goals of the government, really. That is, the whole system itself exerts an influence which is certainly as powerful and permeating as any one oil lobby might be on the Hill. And they do something else with a lot of their surplus value. Most brilliantly, perhaps, were the Rockefellers, but others too. The Carnegies did this, the Vanderbilts, some others. And that is to use a portion of it to gain cultural dominance and cultural hegemony, to create and control the institutions of the United States, the colleges, the universities, the schools, the art, the medicine. It was Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian communist, who made the point that the state is only the first line of defense for the capitalist ruling class. And behind that first line is a whole network of trenches and fortresses which socialize people into a kind of mentality and into a perspective which buttresses the power and force of the state. One could not rule by bayonets alone. So, for instance, today we could see how that kind of consciousness gets permeated, and people will say to you, I heard a steel worker interviewed on TV just the other night. He said, yeah, Reagan's good for the rich, but I don't care because when the rich get richer, there's more jobs for me. That is, he has learned the central myth of capitalism, which is that it's the capitalist who produces wealth and brings it to you and gives you a little of it. All he asks back is your labor, you see. Or when people reject socialism, it's not because they don't like the brotherhood of socialism. It's because they believe and they've been taught and they've been told, and it often proves to be true and functional in this society, that you got to be selfish. And that's part of human nature. So they don't believe it would work. And they think that socialism would be even worse because it would be so bad, etc. I want to close this talk, draw toward the end of it, by mentioning something about Reaganism and Reaganomics. I maintain that Reaganism is not a foolish thing, and I maintain that Reagan isn't stupid. He does all the right things for the class that he so faithfully and skillfully represents. He commits gaffes at press conferences. He forgets names. He doesn't know details of anything and all that sort of thing. But he understands the thing we've been talking about tonight. And he understands that the function of the state is to protect the interests of the ruling class, and the primary interest of the ruling class is to maintain its margin of profits. And the way you do that is the way we talked about before. You drive down wages, and the way you drive down wages is you cheapen the price of labor. You diminish labor's ability to fight back. You break unions. And the NLRB has been handing down some remarkable decisions. And 30% of this economy, labor force used to be unionized. It got down to 25, then 22, then 20, now 18, and now close to 16% as unions are being broken. Two, you increase the supply of cheap labor supply by having more people out on the market. You do that by, for instance, raising the retirement age. You reduce minimum wage, as we say. You turn back affirmative action, One of the things that the historical role that women and minorities have always played is to be a reserve army of labor, of cheap labor. If you've got that pool of cheap labor out there, then you can always hire them and deflate wages for other people, you see. And a very interesting development is taking place in Washington, D.C. today, where you have AFSCME unions going out on strike in support of the women for equal pay, because they've suddenly discovered that when the women in their company are paid lower, that's a drag on their own wages. So they're now talking about affirmative action and equal pay for everybody, that everybody's a worker together. So you see how the fight that women launch for themselves can have a progressive effect on men. Another thing historically done is you deny labor alternative sources of sustenance. The enclosure acts of the late 18th century are the classic development of capitalism in that way. Goldsmith's heart-wringing poems about the death of the British peasantry. When the peasants had alternative sources of sustenance, they had the commons where they could get game, fruit, they could grow some things, they get firewood, they could sustain themselves at a poverty level. When the enclosure acts came and cut the commons off, that was starvation for the English peasantry. And it was deliberately done to send them into the hellholes of Manchester, Lancashire, and London, and places like that, to go work in the factories. It created a proletariat. People are not born as workers. They had to be forcibly created to learn to work 8 hours a day in that way. And so later on in the late 18th century, when the workers went on strike, in many of the great strikes of the 1870s, 1880s in the United States, one of the few things that sustained them was their garden plots in the back. So they started building tenements without gardens. First, more money for the landlord, pile more human beings in there. And second, they have no more access to food. And the whole essence of capitalism is to cut off alternative accesses, to make you dependent on them for food, for energy, for transportation, for forms of recreation, even for the images that you get in your head and the culture that we no longer create because it's fed to us over electronic media, you see. And so with today, Reagan systematically is cutting off alternative sources of sustenance. He attacks unemployment insurance. He attacks AFDC, aid to families with dependent children. He attacks Social Security and disability through more stringent interpretations. Hundreds of thousands of workers who were collecting disability have been cut off. They have forced them to go back on the market to compete. He wants to attack, and he attacks welfare, as I say, the AFDC. He made a very revealing comment. He said, the poor are the only people who don't have to move when they're out of a job. Let them go move. Let them go off where there's a promise of a market. Let them all flood over to where those jobs are, so they can cheapen the price of labor there more systematically and not sustain them here with public human service programs, you see. Now, as that happens, as the attack on people go on, people mobilize, and they fight back to defend their standard of living. And as they mobilize and fight back to defend their standard of living, and as they fight back against the assault on the environment, and as they fight back against the warmongering and the militarism and the arms race and the interventionism, as they fight back against the needs of domestic, local, and global capitalism, you see, then the attack escalates not only against their standard of living, but against those very democratic rights which they are using, which they have fought for all these years, you see, which enable them to fight for more substantive things, which are the substance of democracy. And so the Supreme Court starts handing down a whole bunch of funny decisions now, that apparently the right to travel is not really a constitutional right if the president has certain foreign policy considerations. That's an invitation to unlimited power, and that's a pulling back. The right to hand out leaflets, there have even been decisions on that in some courts, in some areas, prohibiting leafleting, prohibiting forms of political agitation and political organization. These are the kind of struggles we face in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, it's not that socialism threatens democracy, but that democracy threatens capitalism. That's the point. The way to oppose this onslaught, by the way, is not to lean toward the center, to cover your hide, to worry about your political respectability, especially as things are getting so much more conservative. The way, in fact, to oppose these things is to push in an ever more progressive, ever more militant direction, to to generate a countervailing force. That countervailing force is the only thing that's keeping them from doing what in their heart of hearts they really want to do to us. If they really could stick it to us, you'd all be out there working for $1.10 an hour. You'd all be out there working not 8 hours, but 10 hours. They'd have it back like Taiwan and South Korea. They'd double your taxes, etc., etc. Our job is to move the center of political gravity back toward the left, back toward the interests of the many and not to the few, back toward struggles which have to do with substantive human outputs, because those substantive things are also the essence of democracy. What's the use of freedom of speech if you've got an empty belly? I think I want to close right here. And I just recall something that Rousseau, that beautiful essay he wrote called The Disquisition of the Origins of Inequality. You remember there's that passage where Rousseau uses a historical parable. He doesn't really seriously think it happened at some historical moment, but it's a parable, and it's a scene where he says, the troubles all began when that first man put those stakes in and dug a moat, and he said, this belongs to me, and you cannot come in here. And I'll let you in only to gather the fruit from those trees and give me the fruit, and I'll give you one apple or something, and work this land and give me the wealth, and you get out. And then I can use that to get more of that land and dig another moat and get more there, and you can come in a little bit, and you can have little bits of it. And Rousseau says, how many wars, how many lies, how many murders, how many crimes could have been prevented if the people had remembered that this isn't the natural way to live, that for tens of thousands of years, and there are some places still in the earth today, people don't live that way, they don't accumulate capital. The American Indian knew this when he saw the white man, and he said, the love, Sitting Bull's famous quote, the love of possessions is like a disease among them. And he looked with horror as he said, look at them, one man will own 100 horses and yet let his brother walk on bare and bleeding feet. When an Indian knew you only needed one horse or maybe two, what the hell are you going to do with 5 or 6? What do you need them for? How could you sustain them? Why would you do that to your brother when he's essential to your survival too? When people all over the world through the centuries in what was called primitive communism understood that nobody went hungry, that there was a place at the fireplace for everyone. Unless the herd disappeared or the crops failed, then everyone shared the hunger too. And that was the way human beings and mankind lived for 1,000,000 years before this aberration, this thing came along called capitalism. And if the people remembered that, Rousseau said, if the people would remember their heritage and they would pull up the stakes and fill in the moat and they would say, no, away with you, because the fruits of the earth belong to everyone and the earth itself belongs to no one. But ladies and gentlemen, the earth may not belong to us, but we belong to it. It is our birthright and we must struggle for it. And that struggle is our fulfillment. That's part of our human nature and our human transformation, you see. And it's not only that we must love social justice more than we love personal gain, but we discover that the greatest personal gain comes in the struggle for social justice. And we best experience our own personal humanity when we stand close to all of humanity.
You were just listening to Michael Parenti on capitalism. He spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1984. Michael Parenti was a leading independent political analyst, scholar, and author. He's the author of numerous books, including Against Empire. He passed away on January 24th at the age of 92. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. From its early days, Michael Parenti was an integral part of Alternative Radio, with more than 40 programs in our Parenti archive. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.